Hello, I'm Ray Reich, founder and CEO of RevOps Squared, and your host of the Metrics That Measure Up podcast. We talk to a wide variety of B2B, SaaS, and cloud thought leaders, executives, investors, and people just like you to discuss the metrics and benchmarks they use to make metrics-informed decisions. Now on to today's show. Welcome to today's episode of the Metrics That Measure Up podcast. Today, we are joined by Mark Stoos, the chairman and CEO of Proof Analytics. Today, we will be covering three main topics with Mark. First, marketing metrics, lagging versus leading indicators. Second, marketing as an exponential amplifier to sales productivity. And third, return on marketing investment. What are the top three metrics to measure ROMI? Mark, please take a moment to give a brief background of your journey to becoming a guest on the Metrics That Measure Up podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. Basically, I am a communicator who became a marketer and a CMO in large companies, who then turned into a software company CEO. And so I have a very non-traditional career path, and at least in one sense. And part of it, it has pretty much run all the way through the last 20 years or so, has been this whole topic of ROI or impact or, you know, whatever word you want to ascribe to it. How do you prove it, right? How do you actually optimize it? Now, we talk a lot about being able to plan, predict, prove, and pivot. And that really sums it up. I don't care whether you're a marketer or a CEO or somebody else, right? Everybody's having to plan. Everyone's having to give guidance to stakeholders or shareholders about what they think is going to happen. Everybody has to then substantiate that. And then as things iterate, as things change, because we live in a dynamic world, you got to be able to change with it.
I agree. And I love the fact that you started as a communicator. Even though you've had great roles as chief marketing officer and chief customer officer, and of course now as chairman and CEO of Proof Analytics, but let's get right into it. There's all these posts and debates on LinkedIn about the metrics that matter for marketing and specifically for a chief marketing officer. So I'm going to go right into the tough question first. What are the top three kind of company outcome metrics that you think a CMO should be focused on and even own, if not co-own?
Well, actually, that's a very straightforward answer. And I think that while it's a matter of debate among marketers, it's not really a matter of debate among anyone else, right? So if you kind of think about, I'm going to focus this on marketers. So marketing's mission is to help sales sell more product to more customers faster and more profitably than sales could do by itself. That's it in a nutshell, right? So if we kind of look at that in terms of you kind of break out those kind of three basic areas, we're talking about more deals, we're talking about bigger deals, and we're talking about faster deals, faster deal velocity, right? And how does marketing improve sales performance in those areas? That's the big question. I mean, that is it.
Mark, so it sounds like, you know, if you look at more deals, higher value deals, and less time, the ultimate outcome metric to be a marketer should be measured by is revenue trends and revenue growth. Is that right?
It is, but it's also the relationship between what marketing is doing and its time lagged impact on sales. So if you don't understand that marketing and sales create value asynchronously with each other, you're going to have a problem.
Let's double click right into that. So, because you're singing my song, which is, you know, revenue and pipeline are two of the lagging indicators, those high level output metrics that marketing's delivering. But marketers also want to know about what are my leading indicators? What are those metrics that actually impact the size and velocity of both pipeline and new revenue? Can you limit it to three kind of marketing specific metrics that truly are leading indicators, Mark?
Yeah. So part of that is going to be situational within a company in terms of what they're trying to achieve. But I am going to say this. data by itself, KPIs by themselves, are not enough. You cannot get to where you want to go with data only, right? You've got to have the analytics. So data is a measurement of what happened in a particular time and in a particular place. And by definition, it is in the past. There is no forecasting with data by itself, right? You have to be able to use analytics, mainly regression-based analytics, to say, okay, based on what has happened in the past, here is a forecast into the future. And then you've got to be able to recalculate that model to see where the variations are as the future becomes the present, right? And you get a new data set, and then you recompute the model. Are we on? Are we off? Right? It's really a lot like a GPS. You think about a GPS on your phone, right? It's, this is where I am. This is where I need to go. It gives you, you know, a proverbial route to value, right? Your route to your destination. And then it's tracking you, and it's tracking all the things that make the journey work or not work that you don't control. And then it's saying, hey, guess what? There's been a big pile up ahead. If that hadn't happened, it was, you know, stay where you are, but it did happen. So we're going to need to reroute you. The ability to do that is the whole ball of wax.
Mark, I'm going to double click on that because I want to make sure, number one, I summarized and that I understood what you said. Data, rear view looking in the mirror, analytics, or as I say, predictive analytics, takes the knowledge from the past and predicts what's going to happen in the future based upon those data points, right?
Right. And then it also tracks all the relationships between what you control and what you don't control and where you're trying to get to. And it's constantly tweaking it, right? I mean, this is marketing mix modeling, which has been around for, I mean, you know, P&G, Procter & Gamble was the first company to really do that. And it's has proven power, but it has had a lot of problems as well that's kept it from being constricted.
Yeah. Well, let's be very honest, though. B2B marketing, especially in the SaaS industry, which by all accounts is still a fairly young and mature industry. Yeah. I do not think there's a lot of marketing mix modeling going on for B2B marketing and sales organizations. Would you agree with that?
I would totally agree with that. There's a real maturity curve on this whole issue, right? And if you kind of have to start very simply. And by the way, the whole idea that you have to get your data sets perfect and all in order before you do the analytics is exactly backwards. And any data scientist would tell you that, right? So what you've really got to do is you got to say, what are the big questions that we need to answer, right? So this would be marketing's impact on different parts of the business, right? And it's not just sales. It could be recruiting and retention. It could be all kinds of stuff, right? So you've got to say that. And then that suggests a model. And we're not talking about the math yet. We're talking about the outline of a model, right? What does this problem look like? And what is my hypothesis about what I think will work? Because that's what you're going to test, right? And then that ultimately tells you what data you need to have in order to arm that model. So it's not a boil the ocean problem at all. This is not a shotgun thing at all. This is a rifle shot process.
Mark, we're going to double click on that one too, because I had a huge I had a huge debate the other day regarding pipeline coverage ratio. So the two questions are, right. Number one, what's your belief of pipeline coverage ratio as a forward-looking metric to predict if you have this much pipeline, how much revenue? And then number two, do you think companies even understand what are the input variables that could change that pipeline coverage ratio, especially from a marketing perspective?
So in terms of pipeline coverage, I mean, this is actually in some respects more of a sales idea than a marketing idea, right? It has validity in a more mature situation in the sense that by that point, leaders know that for every new sales guy or salesperson that they hire, within a certain amount of time, that person is probably going to generate X amount of incremental revenue, right? So whether we're talking about it in terms of sales guys or whether we're talking about some other aspect of the funnel, it has merit okay? But it's a later stage, you know, pipeline coverage becomes more and more and more relevant the deeper and deeper and deeper into the pipe you go, right? In other words, there is more certainty around it. I mean, I know CFOs, for example, that will not look at this topic at all on anything that is not 80% or higher in terms of being closed.
Well, let me ask a few feedback on something that I still promote is I like to deconstruct based upon the pipeline coverage ratio actual, and especially if it's trending higher, so it goes from 3 to 4 or 4 to 5 over a quarter or two. I try to deconstruct the pipeline, not only on stage of pipeline conversion, but ICP buyer persona to say, oh, in that ICP, which is our top, it's 2.5, but for this new ICP, it's 6.2. So do you think those type of things are instructive?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I think that ICP continues to be one of the most important things that you can do in terms of focusing your sales force correctly and your whole go-to-market correctly, right? I mean, for example, at Proof, the way that we do this is not only in terms of our marketing, but particularly our first meeting, we have a series of questions that we ask that are designed to disqualify customers. Actually, more accurately, to get the customer to, or the prospect, to disqualify themselves, right? And one of the reasons why we do that is that in our business, where a company is on the maturity curve really matters. So if you try and lift a company up in terms of data and analytics that is essentially nowhere on both of those things, right? No one is going to be happy. It's not, you're going to get churned. It's going to suck, right? Because again, you know, we're a startup, right? So we have to place our bets just like anybody else. We're trying to place those bets in an educated way.
I totally agree. Missionary and evangelistic sales has a very different profile than someone who's identified the pain and is looking to, is this the right investment? But right. We could discuss this for hours, but I want to kind of pivot a little bit and go to a post that you recently made on LinkedIn. And you discussed, you know, the concept of marketing acting as air cover for sales, but you actually had a different perspective because you think marketing can have an exponential amplification effect to sales. So can you share a little bit about your insights and almost catalysts for that discussion and post?
Yeah, actually, and there's a great graphic that's out there on this that is really simple, and it's a triangle. There's two triangles. Well, first triangle is divided. The triangle is pointed to the right. The base part of it is marketing, and the pointy end is sales, right? And the implication is that there's marketing, and then there's sales, and there's this handoff, right? And then the second triangle is divided longitudinally from the point, from the apex, right? And it's marketing and sales moving together throughout the entire process. So the analogy in the post was about combined arms operations. So it was the classic military analogy. And most people, when they say air cover, they're talking about a very passive understanding and standoff kind of understanding of marketing. Marketing is doing all this stuff constantly, right? And sales should kind of be grateful and know how to leverage this, right? The reality is that marketing is close air support for sales. So if you're watching the situation in Ukraine, for example, you're seeing Ukrainian Air Force pilots flying very, very close to the ground in direct support of Ukrainian forces in that war, right? And it's a very tactical thing. It's basically the two are totally working together step by step by step to gain ground. That is exactly what a successful relationship between marketing and sales looks like. If you're running a situation where you do your part as a marketer and you get to an MQL and there's a handoff and you kind of go, job done, boom, we're back to the, you know, our own cycle, you are really missing most of your huge opportunity. In fact, the low-hanging fruit for marketing impact is not at the top of the funnel, it's at the bottom. So where I made a, you know, my teams and I made a really big impact, like at Honeywell, was focusing on improving deal velocity, which is a bottom of the funnel idea for the most part. It's the bottom 50% of the funnel. And when you do that, if you improve, so in our case, our revenue at Honeywell Aerospace was $12 billion. If you get $12 billion moving 5% faster through the company, you are the biggest hero in the world to your CFO. Your CFO loves you. It's the reason why the CFO of Honeywell Aerospace is on our board at Proof. It's that right there.
Mark, why do you think so many, I won't even say it's because of the head of marketing, but so many companies believe that marketing is primarily a top of the funnel function and sales owns the middle to bottom of the funnel. And then we have another over to transform to customer success for post-close. And in today's land and expand model, marketing needs to be involved in post-sales. Why do you think that's still part of our culture? Am I just misunderstanding?
Yeah, no, I think you're exactly right. I'm just going to say what I think here. I think that many business leaders that I know, many sales leaders that I know, have been conditioned for years by marketing to see it that way. Marketers have limited their own success by maintaining that they are a demand function and a brand function at the top of the funnel.
Mark,
what about the famous saying? What do you expect? I don't close a deal. I don't have any control over that. What's your response to that?
So if we look at the way that customers make buy decisions, it's a common, and by the way, this is all decision science. I mean, there's tons of research out there. This is not my thing at all, but I have totally seen it in action. It's a combination of awareness, confidence, and trust. Marketing tends to major in awareness. Confidence is something they're also familiar with because that's a lot about customer reference, customer success type stuff, right? Trust, however, is something that we've only seen really come into play in a really substantial way in, say, the last 5 years with ESG type data. The correlations, or, you know, even in a regression model, the impact that trust scores, high trust scores have on deal velocity, for example, are huge. I mean, it's just huge. If you want to drive more deal expansion, so bigger deals, then that's sort of something that most customers in enterprise B2B deal with in the middle of the funnel. That's a confidence issue. Like, the more confidence I have that you're really going to kick it in the ass for me with this product, the more I'm likely to buy from you. And the more I trust you, which means different things to different people, right? But it's not confidence, right? So, like, briefly, as an aside, how many of us know somebody that we've worked with that was incredibly competent in their job, and yet you trusted them not at all? And how many people do we all know that we totally trust, okay, but we wouldn't let them manage our 401k for nothing? That's the difference between confidence and trust. And so when you start really understanding the relationships from the customer side between awareness, confidence, and trust, and more deals, bigger deals, and faster deals, what you are starting to see as a marketer is, wow, okay, so what am I doing that's driving actively on a sustainable basis more awareness, more confidence, and more trust in the marketplace? This can also be, by the way, investors. It's not just customers, it's employees, it's partners, it's all kinds of folks, right? But when you can really understand those relationships, and that's where the analytics is really key, you can fulfill your mission, which again is to help sales sell more product to more customers faster and more profitably than sales could do by itself. That last phrase is key.
Yeah, I'm going to dig a little bit deeper on this confidence and trust, because it's really talking about the velocity and conversion rates of the pipeline. So can you measure confidence and trust through metrics?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, ESG data, particularly not self-reported, but the independent variety, which, you know, there's quite a few companies that provide that. The whole reason why ESG data got hot in the marketing space was because these companies that supply it were supplying it to investment banks. And investment banks were using that data in their models to say, how is this company likely to perform in the future? And they found that ESG data, and there's about 78, 79, 80 vectors on that data, was inordinately predictive. It was really solid stuff. And then the word kind of got out into the investor relations people on the corporate side, and they were like, got to get me some of that data. I want to see what these investment banks are looking at. And then it started just gradually bleeding out. For some, it has become a self-reporting thing and almost like greenwashing kind of exercise. I wouldn't trust that data, but I would trust the other.
Well, the SEC has actually announced they're going to be coming out with an ESG reporting framework.
Yeah, see, that's awesome.
Companies want to follow. Yeah. So, okay, we're going to make one more pivot. I can't believe we're almost out of time, but there was another post that you made and it jumped out at me. And it was about what you learned from life's experiences. One of the things you said was, you know, that wonderful stuff in your life, it needs the presence of struggle and suffering in order to understand, you know, what wonderful is really like and why it's like light needs darkness. Can you share a little bit more about that? Because I think it's so important, especially for founders and entrepreneurs.
So most of my career was inside of large corporations. And by the time I actually went into really big companies, I was then at a director, senior director level, and then I just kept on going up and up and up, right? And so I think that while success and failure certainly exists inside of large companies, you are sort of insulated a bit from it by the fact that there's so many other people around you. The teams are so big, right? And you're always part of the equation. You're not in any way, shape, or form most of it, right? Even as a CMO, I mean, look, most of my success as a CMO was not about my brilliance. It was about my ability to build great teams. That's really what it was, right? So I would say that if you want to really understand that post that I made that you're talking about, you need to go create a startup or go work in a startup. It's an exercise in humility. It's an exercise in balance. To be successful, you've got to both have a strong point of view on whatever it is that you're involved with, in my case, analytics and marketing. You also, though, have to be willing to hear what the marketplace is saying to you, what customers are saying to you, and you have to be able to integrate those two and iterate off of that, right? So suffering. If you want to suffer, or if you feel like that your life could need, you know, could benefit from some suffering, go into a startup. It is the hardest thing I have ever done. It has also been the most rewarding thing I've ever done in many ways, including self-knowledge. I would say it also means that when really great things happen, because, you know, there's an old saying about startups, they're either in trouble or they're dead, which is a fairly dark way of looking at it. But it is, there's a lot more truth to it than untruth. So I would say that, for example, we just won a huge deal with Bayer. And not only did we win it, but we just got a report card on why we won it. And the feedback was just phenomenal. And you struggle so much in a startup in every possible way that when something like that happens, it means so much more. Like you just, the light against the darkness of struggle and suffering becomes even more bright, right? And you just kind of like totally appreciate it. Whereas maybe in another situation, you'd go, that's really cool, but then you'd be on to the next thing right away.
Totally agree. You just said something. We got to share this with our audience because we have a lot of early stage CFOs and CEOs. The feedback from Bayer, if you can share it here in a public podcast, was it based upon great product feature function, great business value that they saw coming from your solution, or the way your team managed the process getting them to become a customer?
In our case, it was all three. You know, one of the things about Germans is that, you know, if they tell you that your product is adequate, that's like high praise, right? And so I was not expecting anything effusive, but we actually got quite a bit of pretty amazing statements about the product. You know, the thing that really meant the most to everybody, I think, was when they started pointing at different Proof team members and saying, you know, you really took care of us. You really let us know repeatedly, not just by what you said, but mostly by way you acted, what you did, that you cared about us and you wanted us to be successful in this area, right? And that's where it becomes incredibly personal. And that's where I think a lot of SaaS companies totally blow it, is because they're trying to hockey stick. They've essentially commoditized the go-to-market process. They've made it really, really transactional and damn near manipulative. And I think that, like, for example, one of the things that we decided when we started Proof was that we would never exaggerate what our product could do, what our software could do. At any given stage, we would be completely and totally transparent and honest, and we would never be aspirational, right? We would never sell the roadmap, right? Particularly as though it were already there, which is kind of what happens a lot. We built so much trust with people just on that basis, where the word started getting out that if you license Proof, if you buy a Proof license and you turn it on, it's going to do exactly what they said it's going to do. And there's not going to be any gap between your expectation and what it is. And as a result, we've had extremely low levels of churn. And that means a lot. And people operate their companies differently. We operate Proof as an extension of our value system, which is churn means failure of confidence, is really what I mean. And so we don't want that for our customers.
I love it. Customer retention is your proof point. A little play on words.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it really is. And I think too, you know, it creates a flywheel where it's not just about the product. That when somebody says something really cool to a prospect, you know, about us, you know, essentially gives us a referral. One of the things they say a lot is those guys, they really care. They'll make you successful.
That's a wonderful testimonial. Okay, we got to wrap up here. Last question. You've been a head of many different large functions. Now you're a CEO and chairman of the board. So short, to the point, tough question. As the CEO, when you're talking to your head of marketing, is, man, these are three metrics I really want you to be on top of, and you present to me every, whether it's month or quarter, what are those three marketing metrics you want to see as a CEO?
I actually don't give anything about the three metrics. I want to see three models that show the relationships between what you're doing and its impact in the context of the marketplace, right? Its impact on more deals, bigger deals, faster time to close, right? That's what I really want to see. So we eat our own dog food, right?
So if you're looking at that correlation between marketing activity and what you just said, more deals, bigger deals, less time, aren't there some metrics to measure that?
No, because the metrics are an important part of the equation. The data, you know, you can't have analytics without the data to feed it, right? But remember, the data is always about the past. It's always about the past. There are no exceptions to that statement, right? So you're not going to be able to extrapolate accurately based on past data short of an algorithm doing it for you. That's regression, right? I mean, this is just plain and simple reality. I mean, you can go to any data scientist, they'll validate the statement.
Totally get it. Okay. Let's give the listening audience an opportunity to know you just a little bit better on a personal basis through three quick questions. Number one, what CEO or company do you think is a must follow today?
I would have to go with Elon Musk, and it doesn't matter how you feel about him or whether you agree with him or anything like that, but he throws off key learnings all over the place, including ones that he probably doesn't intend to throw off, right? you know, learning and making mistakes is really important. But wherever possible, if you can learn from somebody else's mistake, that's the best. I've learned a lot from every CEO I've ever worked with. I learn a lot from just observing Elon Musk and others. And in every case, I've learned a lot of what to do. And I've also learned a lot about what not to do.
That's a good one. Okay. What tool, not your own, should every SaaS company be using to help accelerate their growth?
ESG data. If you do not understand how the marketplace sees you and sees your competition, you're operating without a GPS. It's sort of like, you know, back when I first started driving, you might be the same boat, right? You had a map on the seat next to you, but it said nothing to you about the conditions ahead of you, right? Wasn't able to tell you whether it was an accident or whether it started raining or whether a road closed or whatever. The GPS does. That's the feedback loop, right? The feedback loop for marketers and salespeople and people who run companies is not what you're doing. It is how it is being perceived and received by the rest of the marketplace. If you don't know that basically a problem is building out there that could hurt you, or if you don't know that, man, there's a huge opportunity out there and you can't see it unless you're using data and analytics, specifically ESG stuff, you're going to miss it. I mean, at the end of the day, this is about how we surf the wave. You either surf the wave well or you surf the wave poorly. It's not about creating the wave. We don't create the wave.
You know, that's interesting because for early stage companies selling to Fortune 1000, I'm seeing more and more of their RFPs say, we need to understand your ESG policy. And it's just part of it. And if you don't answer it or answer it correctly, you could be out.
Yeah, no, and I'm a firm believer in that, by the way. But if you don't understand how they see you and how a bunch of other people like them see you, if you don't have a really accurate understanding of that, you're just flying blind. I mean, you're just transmitting. This is a conversation, okay, that you and I are having. But if I just sat here and just pontificated for 20 minutes straight and you never got a word in edgewise, is that going to work for anybody? I don't think so, right?
Totally agreed. Okay, last question. If you were talking to a recent college graduate who says, I want to be like Mark Stoos, I want to be a SaaS or cloud founder, what advice do you give them right now?
I would say that number one, no matter what your area of specialization happens to be, if you don't have a pretty decent mastery of finance and the financial language of business, you are going to have a really hard time. Which, by the way, I would extrapolate that out. And if you're a CMO and you can't read a financial statement, you're not going to be a CMO for too much longer. I mean, that's really, really key. I would say if you really need a mentor, preferably more than one, because like the thing that is kind of like, it's a hard exercise for me to do even today, is to look back and say, oh my God, what I did not know at that time that I desperately needed to know. That is a shocking self-evaluation, right? And you realize just how many bullets you dodge that you didn't even really know were there. And so the more awareness you can build, the more understanding you can build, the more tolerance for pain and suffering that you can build, the better you're going to do. By the way, I would say that is even more true for a non-technical founder than a technical one.
Well, that's great advice, Mark. In fact, I had just a recent guest, Kyle Porter, who's the CEO of SalesLoft, and he said, I needed to grow faster than the pace of my experience. And having mentors and understanding the language of finance, et cetera, was all part of that. But that's got to be an end to today's episode of Metrics That Measure Up. Mark Stoos, who's the chairman and CEO of Proof Analytics, thank you so much for being our guest.
Hey, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And to our listening audience, if you're enjoying and finding value in our guests and our content, it would mean the world to us to go ahead and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app. go ahead and give us that five-star recommendation and even provide some advice on how we can make the podcast even better for you and your colleagues. Thank you, everyone, and thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to today's Metrics to Measure Up podcast. If you would like to learn more about B2B SaaS metrics and benchmarks, please visit revopsquared.com.